Tim Smith, welcoming you to our Room podcast here at Cine Newport, where we are here to expose the stories, the people, the places, and the amazing things about Southern California to the world. I am so pleased today to have a great friend and a great story that I can't wait to get into. CJ Noaker, thank you so much for joining me today.
Tim, it's a pleasure.
So before we get into the story and some of it, I just want to talk a little bit about CJ. Grew up. Tell us a little about where you grew up, because this is a very Southern California, Orange County-based podcast. So where'd you grow up?
I was born in beautiful Burbank, California.
Okay.
Lived there in Toluca Lake till I was about five or so. My mother decided that she wanted to be a beach goer and pretty much sold the house when my dad was at work, and we moved into Huntington Harbor.
Okay.
And that was, I think, 83.
How old were you at the time?
Five.
Okay.
Five or six.
So Toluca Lake, kind of remember it, but not really.
If you're ever at Universal Studios and you're looking down off of like the tour down into the valley side of the world, that closest little enclave is Toluca Lake there.
Okay.
Smokehouse restaurant right there. There's Warner Bros. Studios and all that stuff. Nice little affluent little area.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful little community.
So came down here at five and you guys moved to Huntington Harbor.
Moved to Huntington Harbor.
And so, why did they choose Huntington Harbor?
My mom chose it not only because she was a beach kid, loved sailing. Family loved sailing. We're ocean folk. And also her family was in the neighborhood. Her brother and sister and her mother as well.
Okay.
And my grandma on my dad's side was in Newport Coast, Corona del Mar.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then your whole life is here. So where'd you go elementary?
So I guess I first started at, what was it, a school in the Huntington Harbor area.
Okay.
And then bounced into Huntington Beach as the triangle of Smith, Dwyer, and Huntington Beach High School.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And then after high school, where'd you go?
I moved back up to L.A.
Okay.
I think I spent a little bit of time in Huntington with good buddies. Devin, Nicole, and I moved in together, had some fun in Huntington for a while. And then I moved up to LA and I did about 12 years up there. I think I might have bounced back once, but it's been a good amount of my 20s through my 30s in LA, in the Hollywood area.
And so now your living wife, who's amazing, two kids, you guys are living where?
In Newport Beach.
Okay. And why, tell us a little bit, like the spots and why you chose where you live.
Well, several reasons. I mean, the easy to point out, Newport Beach is beautiful, right? It's all the restaurants, it's sunshine, beaches, and all that shit that we all love. And we have a lot of friends here in the neighborhood, and the kids and everyone get to play together. So there's lots of benefits of being obviously in a small community in that sense. Good schools.
But you've worked everywhere. Like you've been LA, you were in Portland, you're in other areas.
Yeah.
And so now being here, I mean, is there any other place that you'd like to live and raise a family?
No, I mean, with all the things that are happening in the world, I think we're in, I wouldn't say a sheltered, but a kind of
a bubble,
a nice bubble that is kind of immune to some of the things that are outside type of crazy influences. Portland was fun when I was there.
Yeah.
And then it got crazy. And, you know, Portland can be weird. I mean, I think that's one of their
cool
mottos.
Cool city, though.
Yeah, they keep Portland weird. They're keeping it real weird right now up there. So we started having kids.
Yeah.
And when we were setting up business and building businesses up there, it was fun. But I was bouncing home every single weekend to see my daughter. And we had the firstborn at that point. And ultimately, Kaylin made the wise decision. She's, are you going to come up with me to Oregon to start these businesses? And in her wisdom, and
she said,
absolutely not. So she decided that I would, or we decided, more like she decided, that I would be flying home every weekend to see the family. And then I would go back up there Sunday night or Monday morning
early
and do my thing.
So Capri's at Cardin Hall.
She's a Cardin.
Which is right next door.
Yeah.
How did you guys choose Cardin Hall?
It was fairly easy. I mean, we're going through COVID times when it was time to pick this stuff. Right around that zone. And we wanted to put her in a private school. and we had friends in Cardin. Kaylin went to Cardin. Numerous people that we families that we know had their kids there.
Yeah.
And liked it a lot. And we appreciate the curriculum. And that's, we just kind of picked that. It's not too far away.
It's funny because our kids are at Harbor Day. And I just realized this phenomenon. I'm coaching our daughter's football team with Matt Foster. And Matt calls me. He's like, hey, we're going to go to a game and bring all the girls. And I go up there on a bus. And I'm the only guy that every one of the dads went to Harbor Day, went to USC. Their kids go there. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's going to be my son. If they can get in USC at that point, because it's impossible.
I'm sure they will. I'm sure it won't be an issue.
So we were out one night, and I guess, I mean, we've become friends kind of through our wives and through our friend group and our kids. And I never heard the story that I really want to get into today. And when you told me, I mean, for 2 hours, I was like jaw dropped. And I thought, and since I love film, and that's a big part of my life and business, I'm like, we got to make this film. So I want to get into that story.
Okay.
And so just to give a little context, survivor of a helicopter accident over on Catalina Island, which most people around here know, but I want to get into kind of the details. So what were you doing at this age? Like, give us a little context of where you were at in your life.
Well, I was living up in LA,
okay,
working with our family architectural millwork company.
Okay.
At this point, I was single.
Yeah.
Enjoying just having no responsibilities, essentially, just working. And there was a opportunity to go over to Catalina, and I spent most of my adolescent life all summer long going over to the island.
And this was always kind of by boat, because when you're a boat goer, for people that are listening, like Catalina Island's what, 26 miles?
Something like that.
26 miles from Newport or Long Beach. Yeah. You go over there for the weekend, it's epic, come back. I mean, it's just epic, right? And it feels like a little, like, almost island you'd see in, like, Capri or in the Mediterranean, right?
It's a detached little poor man's paradise, as I like to call it.
Yeah, you know, for sure.
Sailing over there, as my dad used to say, it's, you know, wind is free, and we're going to sail over to the island. So we spent a lot of time there. It's very easygoing once you're there. We go to Isthmus for more often than not as a kid, and there's one burger stand and one restaurant, essentially, and two bars on the same property. And my dad and I and the family, whatever, would enjoy lots of time there. As we got older, I would obviously still enjoy it, but I was working a lot more, and one of the times I was able or invited over there by my dad, he was already going to have the boat over there and decided that he was going to invite a couple friends. Steve Sharp and his wife was already there, and his daughter was going to take a helicopter ride. Steve was there. His daughter and wife were going to jump on this helicopter that he had chartered out of Long Beach, an Island Express helicopter. And they had room.
And seemingly short flight, what, 20 minutes, right, easy?
Something like that.
And you had done it many times?
No.
Oh,
so this was the first time ever on a helicopter.
No way.
First time on a helicopter. And the odd things that came up prior to this, as I probably mentioned a little bit before, is that there was weird signs and dreams and
things. Well, let's talk about those. So you're coming up. So your dad invites you. You know it's going. And so give us the...
It was before that. Before I was even invited on, or Steve inviting us on to utilize the helicopter to get a ride over there, dreams about an accident and like me breaking my back. I called my mom at one point and said, like, look, if I ever were to injure myself significantly, this is going to sound wrong, but if I was like a quadriplegic, I mean, I want you to take me out. So that's wrong to say, right?
Yeah.
But if I'm...
And you had that conversation with your mom.
I had that conversation with
her. How many days before the...
A week and a half prior to the...
And what did she say?
I just took it as some sort of, you know, just a dream. You know, you're fine, honey. My mom always looks at me as her fair-haired little boy.
Yeah.
So she just kind of blew it off. It was nothing major.
Yeah.
The very odd thing is when that morning of the flight...
Yeah.
On the flight... There was obviously the pilot assistant, Buddy's wife, Buddy's daughter, and then my dad's girlfriend, Tanya Hurd. And that morning, I went to go pick up,
Yeah, I picked up Tanya.
Yeah.
And she just come off a night of being a chaperone for the high school that she was working at. And she had a great night. And we had a tough relationship through a divorce and then whatever, then my dad and Tanya meeting. But we grew very close.
Yeah.
And in that morning, that drive in, it was very, very interesting. There was a connection, a weird just kind of culmination of all the years experience and the love and tears and all this stuff came to just like we had a really connected drive in and conversation.
And you drove up from LA and you picked her up in Newport?
I was living in LA.
Yeah.
Living in Hollywood and she was in Burbank.
Picked
her up in Burbank.
Okay.
So we were driving down to the helicopter or down to Long Beach to the terminal. And
this was kind of an unusual conversation.
It was very
connection,
like Last Supper type of feeling.
Yeah,
very odd in that sense. Just candid and just open. There's just some sort of something in the air.
Yeah,
I can't really describe it so much of how that was.
Were you actually feeling it at the time, like this, like making, like becoming something, aware of like these kind of points?
Well, it wasn't at that point in during that drive that I felt something was off.
Yeah.
But when we got down to the terminal and they started going through, how much you weigh, blah, 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 and the standard kind of check-in process to determine all the things they need you for pre-flight, something felt weird. And that's when I told the people at the ticketing counter, whatever it was, and Tanya said, something doesn't feel right. I'm not going to get on the helicopter. And she was okay with it, yada, yada. It was like, no, it's fine. Just get on the helicopter. We're going Catalina. It should be a 15-minute, whatever it is, flight to get over to the island.
Yeah.
But I was not comfortable with it for some odd reason. So I called my dad and I left. I go, Dad, something doesn't feel right. I'm not going to get on the helicopter.
Yeah.
Oh, CJ, you're just having some jitters, maybe some sort of afraid of flying or something of that nature. I've never been afraid of flying. I've never been afraid of helicopters or anything like that. It was my first flight, but there was nothing to make me afraid of them for any reason. Just said something's not feeling. Go through your morning routine. Go get your naked juice and come back on. If you're not feeling well, once you get over to the island, we'll put you back on the Island Express, whatever it is, and then send you back over here. Okay. Whatever. So I turned around. I was driving back up to LA.
Yeah. So you were having this conversation. You left.
I left.
You left.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that was a little bit shocking to the people that were there, or maybe not.
Well, I'm not sure how they felt about somebody just kind of canceling and not wanting to go over to the island.
Yeah.
But I could say it was very odd for me. I mean, Tanya was still, you do whatever you need to do in order to make yourself feel good. If you don't want to go, you don't want to go.
Yeah, whatever.
So be it. She's ready to get on the helicopter.
So then you're driving, having this conversation. How far did you drive before you turn around?
Probably about 5 miles. Maybe a little bit more.
Okay.
And so I turn around. Okay, we'll get on the helicopter. Go out there, and then seating arrangement was another interesting kind of scenario, or how it ended up panning out.
Yeah. Did the feeling go away that it didn't feel right?
No.
Okay. You just kind of like pushed through it.
Yeah. We just kind of continue to do it. Yeah. So and I had never met Skylar, who is my buddy's daughter, beautiful lady.
Yeah.
And so this helicopter in particular, was a two-seater pilot, co-pilot scenario, but they didn't need a co-pilot in this setting. And then a bench of four in the back.
Okay.
I'd never been on a helicopter before, never seen the crossing, the channel crossing of the thousands of times I feel like I've done it at that vantage point. So seeing it from sky and crossing, this would be, you would think that would be something you would want to to look at, right?
For sure.
So we started doing the who's going to sit where in the back, Tanya slid in as the first passenger in the back row to go all the way against the window on the far side.
Yeah.
On the right side of the helicopter. And then Skylar slid in. And then the pilot assistant said, CJ, would you like to sit against? I'll slide in. You can see out the window. And I went, no, it's fine. I'll sit in the middle. I mean, maybe it was a sense where I wanted to sit next to the pretty girl or something like that. You know, it's probably pretty
was
clear.
Was it?
I probably. I mean, she was a pretty lady, but, you know, it worked out like that.
Yeah.
And so I managed to I sat in third on the bench, and then the young man sat next to me.
So one pilot, but it's a two-pilot helicopter,
front
four bench seats. You have Tracy here, Skyler here, you, and then the other guy.
Yeah, so it was a pilot, front right, buddy's wife, front left, Tanya, Skyler, myself, and the pilot assistant in the back. So the pilot assistant was against the window, and the Tanya was against the other side.
Yeah, okay.
So go through standard stuff, start up the helicopter, and not being on a helicopter before ever, they feel like they're always kind of shaken apart, I would say. So they're just a little spooky in that sense.
Yeah.
So we finally get up in the air, aloft, whatever, and start making our way across the channel. Very wet marine layer type of morning, lots of water coming off of the windshield, you know, a little bit of whatever you want to call it, rain, but it was some precipitation out there. Always looking up and looking at this thing going like, is it going to rattle loose and we're all just going to fall out of this thing as we cross? Still, I can see out the front. It was beautiful. Right? It's still.
But never got over the uneasy feeling.
No, it was always there, just anxiously waiting to
Which can happen anyway if you're flying for the first time, but it was more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a way to... People have premonitions or feel weird things all the time, and I still... You know, and you may, and you're like, what? Something feels off.
Yeah.
And you're not gonna. I'm not gonna stop my life. Typically, even if you know, I'm not gonna get in the car today, or and something like that. Something just feels weird. A strange dream.
Well, I've never told you this, and we'll get back to it. But I usually go on this motorcycle or K&M trip to Mexico, and we had planned it with some buddies for months. And we had everything we needed, and I could not get comfortable. And it was after you told me this story. And I'm like, I've been down there before. And literally the night before, I'm just like, I'm not going. Right? Everybody went, and my buddies were just like, are you kidding me? Like, you've already paid for it. I'm like, I'm just not going, dude. I don't know why I'm not going. I didn't go. Everything was great. It was the greatest trip ever. I came back. I just couldn't get comfortable. But I literally came up thinking, I almost called you and thought, what did the premonition feel like? Anyway, continue.
I hope I didn't ruin that trip there for
you. No, it was fine. It was fine.
So I don't live my life by that anymore, right? You gotta live. Right?
But you gotta trust your gut. But there's times in life where you do get messages that I think that you have to be in tune with you to be like, you know what, I'm okay.
Certain scenarios.
Yeah,
right.
For sure.
You know, obviously jumping out of a plane doesn't feel right. Yeah. You don't want to jump out of a plane. So in this sense, so as we're crossing and still having those jitters.
Was Skyler? I mean, were you talking to
everyone? Skyler? So I was talking to the pilot and everyone was talking. There was nothing. I was the only, I guess, uneasy individual.
Yeah.
I think Tanya might have been a little hung over there, but just looking forward to getting over there. And we all were looking forward to getting a buffalo milk, which is a famous island cocktail that we at least get one or two of those as soon as we land.
Yeah.
And or as soon as we get to the island. Just kind of, you have to do it.
Yeah.
So we get close to the island. And we could see, flew over my dad's boat, and my sisters and my little brother were on the boat, pass by Wave, and then make our way to the landing location. Now, if anybody knows Isthmus fairly well, there's not much to it. So you've got essentially the two harbors, Doug's Two Harbor Reef Cafe, which is the kind of the main bar and restaurant there. And then you fly over that. And then you have the Isthmus Yacht Club, Little Red Schoolhouse, the Isthmus Yacht Club.
Yep.
And up to the left, up the road a little ways, a couple hundred yards, is the Banning House, which is the bed and breakfast there, the only place where you could rent a room there. But that's where the landing pad is.
Yeah.
So as we fly over the water, wave to everybody, then we got about to the right before the Little Red Schoolhouse. And at this point, I think we're about 300 feet, maybe a little bit higher in the air. And then we heard a large explosion, essentially. And at that point, and I've not been in a helicopter before, but a lot of BS Discovery Channel knowledge and just knowing things about flight and stuff like that, where I understood the mechanics and of how a helicopter flies and all that kind of stuff. So As soon as the explosion occurred, everyone got very silent. I continued the conversation through the headset and the microphone to the pilot. He said, we've had a catastrophic engine failure, and he clutches in and keeps the helicopter blades freewheeling. At this juncture, you have some major decisions to make,
yeah,
and they have to happen quickly.
Yeah.
So he, in that forces an auto rotation or essentially a controlled crash, high speed descent.
Yeah.
So you want to get that helicopter descending fast enough where the wind is going over the helicopter, the blades, to keep lift.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure you're maintaining that. And you get one shot. You slam it and in the land of auto rotations, and I'm no pilot, but the odds for a successful auto rotation limit are lowered significantly once you get below 500 feet, if you're starting below 500
yeah.
feet, because then you don't have the time to get things going or make any sort of minor corrections as you're doing your conducting your auto rotation.
Yeah.
So when this is going on,
and the mood in there right there, nobody's talking.
But silence, you. Dead yeah. silence, and the pilot and I were having conversations.
Were you guys holding hands at this point?
So I did good. I brought that up. So to you before. So after, as I was talking with the pilot, I asked Skyler. I said, you should link your arms in with mine, cross over. And so we can stay together, linked together, because in an instance, if we were to crash, there's still so much pent up energy within the helicopter that there's a good chance that we're going to roll.
Yeah.
And if we can stay together in yeah. the middle, then we centrifugal force won't push us out and we get caught up in the roll and get injured.
Yeah.
Right. So, we linked up. I can't remember exactly what time or when we linked up while I was still continuing to talk to the pilot. So I said to the pilot, you're obviously going to auto-rotate, yes. And we were at this point right over like by the Little Red Schoolhouse.
Yeah.
And he's starting to make his way toward the baseball field, which is down further, but just heading behind the Hispanic Yacht Club.
Could your family, your dad, could they see what was happening, or had you already flown over?
So when we crossed over them, they saw the smoke coming out of the back of the helicopter before the incident occurred. So they went, oh, that's weird, whatever. Yeah. And when we, obviously when the incident occurred, we finally, they crashed, they saw the big plume of smoke or whatever, maybe fire, whatever. I don't think it was fire. It was just more of a big yeah. plume of smoke that came out of that juncture. And then they came in and chased us down. So before we got, when we got to the, over the Little Red Schoolhouse and he started heading back toward the, behind Isthmus Yacht Club, he said, yeah, I'm going to head back. There's an open field back there. And he started his controlled descent or his auto rotation. And at some point during the auto rotation, at this point, we're definitely linked together, Skyler yeah. and I, and it's still quiet.
Yeah.
I mean, you can hear a pin drop. You can hear the blades. There's no engine noise. It's very, very silent in the helicopter, except for the conversation I'm having with the pilot. And he started his descent. And like you said before, you get one chance to slow that helicopter down. And that's when you do that right before the ground, because after you lose your lift with your little wings or your helicopter blades, you're falling right yeah. at that point. So I think we got to about 100 feet and he flared. And so he used that last point of lift or time that he could actually get some lift out of the helicopter and lost it. So at that point, we started falling, obviously. Yeah. That was very quick.
Yeah,
The only thing I was able to get out of my mouth at that point is we're going to hit hard. And then we hit the ground, and it knocked us all out, right? So we coming to from that, and I think I was probably, I don't know, I want to say maybe I was knocked out for a minute.
Yeah.
Something like that. Maybe a little bit longer. I no frame of reference. I couldn't tell you. I woke up with my head between my legs, and there was a little bit of moaning, groaning in the helicopter, and I righted myself. So I picked my head up and just brought my straightened my back up to the seat. Immediately knew that I broke my back. I knew that it was the most painful, most excruciating pain that I could ever imagine anybody going through. It was, couldn't even think about it. I don't even remember the pain, right? Yeah. It was just that intense.
Yeah.
So I looked over at Skylar and woke her up a little
bit. So you guys were still in the helicopter, what was left of it.
Yes.
And were you the only two in the helicopter?
No. At that juncture, it was myself and Skylar, and I believe the pilot and my friend's wife, Laura. And but the fuselage of the helicopter was destroyed, right? There was nothing to my left side. Everything was crunched like you would not believe. And what I did is I didn't know. Well, at this juncture, I are you okay? Talk to Skylar. If we're okay, we got to get out of here. And I undid my seatbelt with the anticipation that I'm just going to get up and walk out of this helicopter. That didn't go so well. I just crumbled. So thought to myself, well, that's not good.
Yeah.
I thought that I had just kind of stung my spine where my legs weren't working yet at that point. So I commando crawled out of the helicopter, got maybe about 6 feet away, and I, maybe a little bit more, rolled over onto my back and made an effort to push myself up off the ground and, you know, try to help and try to, you know, stand up again. Second most painful experience of my life. So then I knew I my legs weren't working, right? So I had damaged the back bad enough where I was a paraplegic essentially at that point. It was just paralysis in the legs. I look in at this point, I think there was just more commotion within the helicopter. And I could see, unfortunately, there was the Tanya, and I believe the young man's name was John, that had got caught up in the wreckage and the roll. And they were unfortunately engulfed in flames in the wreckage right there. I couldn't move. I was basically helpless at that point. Skylar, luckily enough, she got up and got out of there, but there's nothing she could do. I think she broke her pelvis and some smaller lacerations, and as to my best of my recollection. And then a young man came over to try to help. And he's, you know, said, what can I do? I said, please just pull like Tanya from the fire. Please, you can just get her out of the wreckage. And tries to get close. And he said, I can't, it's just too hot. It's too hot. I can't do it. I can't get in there. And I probably could have handled this a little differently, but there was a lot of shit going on right there. I called him every name in the book. Don't be a pussy.
Yeah.
Get in there and, you know, you might get your hands burnt, but you're going to save somebody's life.
Yeah.
Get in there and pull or just yank her out of the wreckage. And he couldn't, and he ran away. Now, I thought about that a lot during that, you know, obviously that year more of healing. And that was a lot asking for this guy. I could only imagine, you know, what he was going through after that is probably pretty tough for him to deal with that in that instance. So, laying there on the ground, helpless, an older woman came out of Isthmus Yacht Club, and she said, I can't carry you, but I can drag you. I said, okay. You know, and she said, I can't help everybody else. It's too late. And so I gave her my arms, and she started dragging me away from the wreckage. And at that point I could see my right foot was not acting like a right foot should, and it was bouncing all over the place, and I knew that there was something wrong with that leg. So they pull me off at this point that the medical team, or let's just say paramedics or people that are essentially the bartenders and all the people that kind of work there as a cook or whatever, jump in and act as the team that's going to help people, whatever, that the paramedics and started attending to me on the ground. I think John, the pilot, or I forget this, could be wrong with his name. The pilot had a heart attack on the ground. After them pulled him out, he perished. The kid sitting next to me in the seat, he got caught up in the wreckage. He perished. Tanya, unfortunately, as well, got caught up in the wreckage, and she perished in the accident as well. Buddy's wife, she came out of it beat up really bad as well. Internal damage. Damage to her ankle really, really bad. And that's when a couple helicopters flew in to get us out of there. I was in my favorite jeans, one of my favorite sweaters, and I try to sense, in even times where I shouldn't have a sense of humor, try to have a sense of humor in this moment. And they're coming and trying to, you know, they're working on me, and I said, it cut off my jeans on my right leg, and he, don't look down. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to look down. I couldn't feel my legs anyway at that point. They did touch my toes. They said, can you feel this? And I said, yes. And you could feel the sigh of relief from everybody on that was attending to me at that point. And I made some stupid joke, like, all I wanted was a buffalo milk. You know, this is, yeah. It's just trying to get a drink here. Something yeah. like that. And I had my favorite prune colored G-Star. Sure, I was a G-Star junkie. I think sadly I still am, you know, just still that guy. And they said, we gotta cut off your oh, I think everybody, yeah, we gotta cut off your sweater. No, I can take it off. I can take it off. So I started to peel it, and one of the paramedics grabs it and just takes his medical shears and just cuts a giant hole in it because your sweater's done.
Yeah.
You know, like we're cutting it off.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah.
And that's in that moment here, I'm thinking about my sweater rather than being paralyzed and my leg being, you know, fucked up. And I lost my BlackBerry and my Oliver People glasses in the helicopter. And I think I made, could somebody go get my cell phone and my glasses out of the helicopter? So I was still trying to find some comedic relief in a moment that there was no.
Where was Skylar at this point?
I couldn't tell you exactly where she was being attended to somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone was with very close proximity to where the wreckage was. So the Coast Guard helicopter comes in. We see all, you know, that one that flies the Sikorsky or whatever it is. And then a Army double-bladed crazy looking thing flies in as well. They get me onto a stretcher.
Is this minutes after? Is this hours after?
Oh, this is so. I would say they probably got me, or they landed there. I want to say maybe 25 minutes after the incident. They probably got on the ground there. I'm sure they were deployed pretty quick. Maybe a little bit after. It's you know, it's kind of hard to get a sense of time.
Did you think I don't want to go back in helicopter?
Oh, you can bet your bottom dollar that it was
Did you say that?
So they put me in the helicopter.
Like, no more helicopter for me.
I look at these poor bastards in that thing, and I look at this guy. I go, you have to understand that this is the last place I want to be. It's another helicopter. Yeah. And he says, rest assured that this helicopter is not going down.
Like, yeah.
Well, that's what the last guy said. You know? Right. But they get me out of there and shuffled me over.
Did your dad and the people did they get up to you guys?
Okay. So yeah, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself. There's some elements there. They saw the incident and they rush ashore.
Yeah.
This has got to be heart wrenching for them. Very, very, very tough moment for my brother.
Yeah.
He, as they come upon the scene, Tanya is still in the wreckage. I mean, that's got to be the hardest thing for my brother to see. His mom on fire in the wreckage, and my sister, who were very, very, were very close, and her, like me, being hurt on the ground and broken. She was heart wrenched. I think my dad was just kind of in shock, right? Yeah. So my sister's crying, and Max is, I don't even, I can't recall. I mean, I'm sure he was just stunned. And Mike, I can remember my sister crying and just asking if I'm okay or something of that nature. And that gets a little bit blurry in what was happening there, but they managed to see way too much, right? And that I wish they wouldn't have seen the things that they saw, especially my brother. That's too much for a young man. And I think he was maybe 12.
Mm.
In this instance,
just a little older than our kids.
Yeah, really, really, and something that a young man should never have to deal with, right? And never see something as tragic or as, you know, as gruesome, but very hard to watch that type of something like that. So they were with us, and then they put me on the helicopter, and they everyone obviously was going to go back to the mainland and deal with the situation at hand. So they fly me to.
Did they give you something for pain at that point?
They shot me up with some morphine on that helicopter.
So you weren't feeling the pain.
I was
like
feeling. It was still painful.
Yeah,
it was still painful. Just enough to keep me calm because those helicopters still rattle and shake.
Yeah,
and you could imagine the back pain going on and this. Well, that's still still occurring. So they take Laura. And I don't think they had to put Skylar on a life flight with her broken pelvis, but I don't remember. So they put me or Laura in the Coast Guard copter and they took her to UCLA or USC, and they took me to UCLA Trauma Center in Torrance, which was an absolute dog shit hospital. We have limited trauma centers in Southern California. They've closed most of them left and right. And so they get me over there. And at this point, I knew before I even got out of there that I had double compound fractured my right tib fib and I broke my back. There's no doubt in my mind about that. So they get me over to UCLA Trauma and they need to get me into CAT scan MRI. They stick me in this machine and they roll, they put picking me up and putting me under this plastic tray to stick me in the tube to find out what was going on there. And I remember those freaking bastards just roll my back over the plastic edge.
Mm.
And that just hurt. Another just absolutely painful moment. So mm-hmm. the hospital stay itself, or I went to two different hospitals.
Yeah.
First was UCLA Trauma from ICU step down into more of a standard room where other people are jacked up in. It was a terrible experience. Sorry to say this for people at UCLA Trauma Center, but it was a terrible experience. The nurses, for the most part, were fantastic, but the doctors and how they treated me there was less than humane. For at one point, I was sitting in the ICU, and the beds will shake just to keep stimulation sometimes. So they'll set it up for us so people get bed sores and get blood flow. And in the middle of the night, and the bed starts bouncing. And you can imagine that's the last thing that I wanted was with a broken back.
Yeah, especially what you've been through. Yeah, right?
Broken back in the ICU.
Yeah.
And they come over apologetic. Oh my God, this shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
They hadn't done any surgery at this point.
And how long had you been here this time? Is this one day or a couple of days?
So they brought me in. They put me in surgery. They took care of the leg. They put a metal rod in my leg from knee to ankle.
Okay, so, right away.
Yeah, my osso buco. It's right down the middle of my bone marrow's canal, right? Whatever that canal. Right away, they got that done. And then they get me into ICU, and then the step down, and then they start talking about This was May 28th or something, if I could be off on that. Might have been the 27th. So I was turning 30 on the 31st of May. So I had my 30th birthday in the hospital there. And we were planning a big party up in Hollywood, a bunch of people up on Santa Monica, some cool club at the time. And I was still convinced that this party is happening. I'm going to get there. If they have to get me into a ambulance and down to this bar, we're drinking. This is happening. I'm not going to let some little, broken back
slow me down.
Yeah, I was determined. And everybody was letting me know, look, I don't think you're going to the the bar at their birthday. So they get me into a point of stability. They hadn't conducted surgery. I was on significant drugs. And I remember my dad coming in, and we were looking at my feet. You know, you're on your bed and you're looking at x-rays. And I remember dad saying, he's like, I'm no doctor. I mean, I'm cabinet maker, millwork guy. But that picture of that leg, I mean, it doesn't look right. And then we look at my foot, and we're just, one foot's a little splayed. Like, maybe they didn't set things a little properly there. We're like, yeah, that looks a little bit off. But so that's when they already had the rod in the leg and screwed up. So there's, you know, it was academic at that point. So they started, what was really annoying, is the UCLA professors, whatever, would bring their students through. And they just turn off. They don't have feelings at that juncture. You're just a case study type of thing.
Yeah.
There's a young man that was in a helicopter accident, T12 burst fracture. So what that means is think about the, you know, brick breakers, the martial arts brick breakers, when you've got a stack of bricks and they're able to focus that energy on a whatever number brick and just break that brick. So my thoracic 12 vertebra burst. So it turned to like just stardust. So that it, when they did my x-rays, you could see all little dots of bone fragments through my body cavity. And it was very, just looked like stardust everywhere. And they said, you know, we didn't do surgery, which is a blessing right there.
Right.
Usually they want to do surgery
like right away. Yeah.
Right. They didn't want to do surgery, so that we think maybe we just let it heal and we'll see where it goes. But before then, they get the PT, physical therapy guy, whatever, in there, and they try to do an assessment. People were coming in, like in wheelchairs. People are sending friends in that are in wheelchairs. CJ, it's okay. You know, there's life beyond legs, or you can live a fantastic life in a wheelchair. Buddy, you can roll your way out of here.
I'm sorry. Not hearing it.
I'm not doing it. I'm sorry that happened to you, but this is not my end game here. I'm gonna persevere through this. I'm sorry. Like, you come here with good intentions, but I'm not listening to you.
Right? Yeah.
It's just get on out. So this one, another horrible incident in the hospitals, they get me wrapped up in a clamshell to keep me stable. And then they try to take you out to walk. So this point, I had a giant cast on my right leg, which was basically like a stability point. I couldn't, my calf, no, the legs weren't working.
Yeah.
And they take me out for an assessment and try to get there walking. I was a young man of strong stature. It was good fit. In good shape. So I get out in the hallway and I'm on these crutches and I'm basically balancing myself on these crutches and just using my right leg as like kind of a pivot point or just a stabilization tool. I couldn't move it worth a damn. I was just kind of balancing on it and we're moving through and I'm just, we went 10 feet. I'm like, oh, let's turn around. Let's get you back to the bed. And I'm sweating profusely. It was very, very difficult to do all this. And I get into the back in the bed, and I look at the guy. I said, "How's it going? What'd you think?"
Yeah.
And he says, "That didn't go well. I mean, that's not good." And not, I mean, at that moment, hey, not so bad. Give somebody some encouraging words. Great job. I mean, super good effort.
Yeah.
Let's see what we can do. That didn't go well. I mean, it was like a heartless, just punch in the gut. Like that didn't go well. So just. Each killing my ability to feel good about where I was going to be at every moment.
Did you still have like that thought, like this isn't my end, or was that
always.
Were you starting to doubt that?
Never.
Okay.
I mean, if I had a bad moment, I always would bring myself out of that moment.
Yeah.
And there's my dad would say, if you don't get your foot off my face, I'm going to lose my sense of humor. I was always just like positive and through that. Then when I was getting to before the students that would be with the professors coming into use me as a study or educate these medical students, they would grab a pencil and put it against my foot and say, push, push, you know, and I couldn't. I'm focusing like you would not believe.
Yeah.
To push, and nothing's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, I could feel them touching my skin, which is a good sign, but I could not push. And so they would say, oh, and you would look at him, you can't do this and the other, and this is, well, we'll go through a little bullshit. I'm like, hello, I'm right here. I'm human, you know, you can, hey, how you doing? It was none of that. It was like, and I mean, I understand that they've got to go through these things without emotion just to try to, whatever. I didn't care. It's like, I felt it was a heartless type of thing. So they move out. And when it came to the burst fracture, not only did I was very lucky. You know, I think I made the term to you, like they said I didn't go complete, or you know, I didn't cut my spinal cord. So that's where things get really, if I were to obviously sever it, there's no putting it back together. That would make me complete, and there would have been a paraplegic at that point. So UCLA basically said, we'll give you maybe 10% use of your legs, based on what their experts were saying there. And it just so happened, I mean, my now wife's family was freaking out and doing kind of the only people that were sane in this moment, where my father had lost his girlfriend or
life partner,
and his son's potential paraplegic in the hospital. He's just blank faced and couldn't think about what was going on there. My wife's family kind of shook. Like, my family said, like, you got to get him out of this hospital.
Yeah.
This place is not going to do him any good. And it rattled my dad to the point where he says, oh, I got to call, see what friends I have to see if they have a better solution, or a better spot for CJ to recover or heal.
UCLA at that time saying, we got to perform surgery now on your back?
No.
Okay. So that was never a recommendation.
Nope.
Okay.
They were going to let it like heal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm no doctor, but it just didn't seem like that was a good option. After coming to, after coercion by my in-laws at this now, he got a hold of a buddy of his, Dr. Joel Matta, who is a inventor of a hip and pelvis surgery, a hip replacement table, where you can go in on a Friday and be back to work on a Monday from this hip replacement. And he got a hold of a team of doctors out of St. John Medical Center out in Santa Monica. And Dr. Rick Delamarter and his team. And they sent over all the information from obviously the Prince and everything to his group. And they said, we can get his legs working again. We got to get him out of UCLA and over to St. John, and we'll perform surgery, and we're confident that we can get his legs working again. Well, fan-fucking-tastic, right? Yeah. You know, like, let's get me out of here.
I'm not missing my party.
No, I'm not. At this point, I mean, so I was in UCLA Trauma Center for 4 days, 5 days, maybe six. I could be wrong there. It's all a blur. I can remember a story in the hospital where I could see this, I couldn't see this gentleman next to me, but it's almost like a voice through the curtain, and very nice guy. He was in there for a completely different issue. I mean, in this room when they got me like stepped down, whatever, out of ICU, and in my last room before I transferred out, there was a guy next to me that I was dealing with issues due to obesity. There was a guy with an open stomach wound that had gotten shot. Another guy got like cut his fingers off. You know, I was in this smorgasbord of all these injuries in this room. And in one morning, I woke up in extreme pain. And we would talk, and he would, hey, how are you doing today? Not good, you know, not good. And there wasn't much conversation there. And he says to the nurses, like, look, dude, this guy's in major pain. Get him some Dilaudid, like something to help so he can, you know, bear getting through this, whatever, help his pain. And they did. They listened to him.
Yeah.
And they brought in this Dilaudid painkiller. Now, that felt, they shot this stuff in me, brother. I was just like, wow, I'm hallucinating in the hospital. I was back to cloud nine. And I could have, at that point, I could have done anything. I was back on a motorcycle right then. So, I mean, it was interesting. And he would tell me his, you know, what he was there for. And it was clear that he was there for.
During, like, the nights, do you remember, like, I mean, were you sleeping at night?
Yeah, essentially, they knock you out. I mean, you know, yeah. It's like things are more painful at night. Your immune system starts to shut down.
And what was kind of your thought process at that time? Because obviously, you didn't know how your story was going to end, but it was always like, I'm walking.
Yeah, it was, you know, what's the next day in store? And I always felt that healing or sleeping was the best way to heal.
Yeah.
So I got through the nights by way of drugs. It was fentanyl and a multitude of drugs, of cocktail to keep me asleep. And when they got me out of, I mean, I was in a drop foot cast because your feet start to fall during a spinal cord injury like that. And then they can lock up in that scenario and it's very tough to get them back. So they get me the battle that happened with myself and the, let's say, hospital administrator or the director of a hospital was very interesting. She comes in and we were transferring me out. I was going to St. John. I want to get my fucking legs working again.
Yeah.
She comes in and says, CJ, I understand you want to transfer out of the hospital. Absolutely. There's an opportunity to get my legs working again. Well, you know, we don't just do that. We don't just let people go like that. So why? She says, well, it's a bad look for the hospital if we let you go somewhere and somewhere else can actually basically help you. I told her to go take a fly-in. You know, lots of expletives came out at that point. And you can pound sand because I'm out of here. I don't give a shit about the reputation of the hospital.
Yeah.
And they got me out of there at night, got me over or very early in the morning, got me... Maybe it was at night. Anyway, so I go to St. John very early that next morning. They put me in surgery. They're wheeling me down to the OR. I look in this room was, I look like a room of torture. Essentially, they had a look like a spigot. You know, they were going to put me on this thing and flip me around. There was a Makita drill.
Like a big rotisserie?
Yeah, exactly. Like a rotisserie spigot, like whatever. And I was a spindle. I'm going, this is not going to be good. I'm going to get skewered in here. And looking at this table of all the tools, and I said, the only thing that's missing on that table is an apple that you're going to stick in my mouth.
While did you say that?
I absolutely said that. So they made a joke or laughed at the joke. And they get me under the knife, and you count to 10. I made it to 2, whatever it was. And I wake up in the recovery room and I look down and I could wiggle my toes.
No way.
So that's the most surreal moment you could ever feel of going from, you know, not being able to use your legs to be able to wiggle your toes. Now, there was a lot of, it's not like I was back to normal. There was some interesting asymmetry between one leg and the next leg and toes were doing some weird things.
Yeah.
But I'm still hopped up on drugs. I'm screaming and laughing and just promising everything. You get a house and you have Oprah in the hospital and everybody was getting everything. You know, everyone was dying laughing at this moment. I was elated and obviously hopped up. And that hospital was fantastic.
All the family's there. Kaylin's there.
Nobody was there.
Nobody was there. Just all the doctors.
All the doctors nurses, and like recovery nurses and everything like there. And there was a party going on in that place as far as I'm concerned. And they get me up to
Has anybody got a bottle of Don Julio 1942?
I was ready. Let's go. You know, it was. Unfortunately, they did not.
Yeah.
So, they get me up, and I had to spend. I think I spent another 10 days there. The nurses there were absolutely fantastic, except for one. So they put me in this drop foot cast. I mean, there's a couple stories. So
people would come to visit me, and I had a lot of visitors all the time, obviously family and friends. And at this point in my life, I was like smoking pot and stuff like that. And they weren't going to let me do that in the hospital. But my buddy would come and, you know, let's get CJ some fresh air.
Yeah.
And take me out of the hospital and you know, get me like stoned on the outside the building, whatever it was, and bring me, wheel me back in. And they didn't care. It's fine. You know, you do what you got to do. And the girls there were fantastic. Except for one night, the head nurse had taken over this position because the girl couldn't make it in. And she says, we got to take you off all your meds. We're going to wean you off, put you on something else. And we got to put you in a drop foot cast, which was like this cast. It's like sheepskin, really real hot. And that night the heating was out. It was just, or like the air conditioning was out. So it was just 85, felt like 90 degrees in there. I'm in this drop foot cast, back in pain, like you would not believe. And the girls come in the morning and I'm just covered in sweat and just dying in there. What happened? And, you know, no meds and this, and the other. It was in, and they immediately hopped me up with drugs again like that and get me comfortable. So I had nothing but amazing things to for
when you could move your toes. Like, was it everybody's opinion at that point he's gonna walk again or no?
I'm not sure where that came, how they were feeling or the doctors were feeling. I mean, they told me, and I've used this term, said, CJ, this is very rare. You're like a snowflake.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, snowflake. Yeah. That's the name of the movie.
Yeah, right. So you're like a snowflake. This is not common. You're very, very lucky that, you know, you didn't go complete. They cleared out the spinal canal, and basically it was all the bone fragments pressing against my spinal cord that they diligently and carefully pulled off of the spinal cord and relieved and got things talking again. So I'm not sure if they said you're going to make 100% recovery.
But you were still like, oh, I'm walking again.
I'm partying. Let's go. I'm going to be running. Let's get this done. So at that point, they said, it's going to be a long recovery. You're going to be in a hospital bed for, you know, a year. You don't want to do it here. So we set up my house where I was living with a hospital bed and 24-hour nursing care and physical therapists at various stages or various, you know, you get three essentially, would show up, and you go through phase one, graduate to phase three, how they were treating you. And in my hospital, I was living in the Hollywood Hills, had a beautiful view of LA, living with my buddy. And with a nursing care. I mean, that first night that we got home, or I was in my house, there was a party at my house.
Yeah.
They and the poor nurse.
Yeah.
One of my buddies managed to give this girl a edible, and she lost her mind that night, and had to be picked up by her boyfriend, and they had to swap out another nurse.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of a, you know, let me take your drugs. Everyone was like, no, those are mine type of thing. So everyone was elated that I was home. The recovery process, I was a psycho. You know, I was nuts. I would push so hard that they were telling me, like, you gotta stop, you gotta slow down. Like, you can pound sand. I am balls.
What was the thought there? You're just like, no, I need to get back.
Yeah.
I don't got time for this.
No, I mean, I'm just like
30 years old, I got life to live.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
engaged at the time or just dating Kaylin?
She was dating somebody else.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, we started dating shortly. I mean, I think we dated like a while after that. I mean, she was dating some other individual.
Yeah.
I was just healing. I mean, she came up. There's a story that we'll get to there in a little bit. And I'm not sure what I can and can't say on this. on
whatever you want people to hear.
We'll give it enough. We'll give them enough. So the healing process, I would go in there, they're telling me I was crazy. I immediately graduated for that first stage of physical therapy, just pushing crazy. I mean, sweating profusely, just pushing so hard. And you could see every week I'd go into to the doctor and you could see I told you, like the stardust in my back. Every week was getting a little bit closer to the break. And ultimately all those bone fragments went back to the spinal my spine.
Just that's what your body does.
I mean, it brought it back. Now it doesn't look like the Mona Lisa or anything. Yeah. It looked more like maybe Shrek after the fact. But it was all the bone fragments did manage to get back to the spine. And they fused my back. So they put four screws and two rods to fuse my T11 to L1. So I had those. I've had them taken out since, which was, I could feel it. They were protruding from the back. It was very uncomfortable. So I blasted through phase one of my recovery or the physical therapy. I mean, and just pounded through step two. And I was in my wheelchair, a big Lakers fan at the time. I had a metallic purple frame on my wheelchair and yellow spokes we'd go to Laker games and stuff like that, Dodger games. And I mean, I was a psycho. We were going down the hill what's that sushi spot above the Magic Castle? I'm forgetting the name of it by now, but we'd roll down the hill. The guys holding me, it was a prime to break my back again. We'd go to bars. I think it was it Happy Endings was actually the name of this bar, and girls always like the guy in the wheelchair. They're going to fix him.
Yeah.
So it was we had good times amongst the pain and sorrow through.
How long? So after phase one or whatever you call it, like, was that weeks? Was it a month?
It was, I think it was probably a month of that first process, which usually they say it was like 2 to 3.
Yeah.
So I went through that. And then the second one, I think it was, 2 months of that step, the stage. And then I did the third for, I think it was another 2 months, but then I always did it myself.
Yeah.
You know, I was just working out as much as I possibly can. I mean, I'd sit there with barbells or dumbbells in my hands, trying to get my arms back in shape. And you're sitting down and standing up and sitting down and standing up. I slept in an upright position with a clamshell around my back for 23 and a half hours a day. And they took it off to just clean the wounds and do me like a spit bath, like a bird bath type of thing to clean me up. And I was weaning off the drugs. I didn't like the drugs. I mean, if pain makes you let you know you're still alive type of thing. And I always wanted to know my limitations of sorts. So I didn't want to overdo them. There was a point where I was using some pain management jerk out of Santa Monica that would just liked injectables. So he would just inject my legs and inject stuff with just local BS. And that hurt and never lasted. And I went to a proper pain management guy. He got me on a proper regiment. I mean, it was all the bad things that are around, like fentanyl and stuff that kids are dying of now.
Yeah.
But it was very regulated and we were on it and I wanted off of it.
Yeah.
I mean, so I wanted to get to as least as I possibly could. And I did that quickly. And I would end up even at the if it was about a year and change, or maybe a little bit less, in that condition of in that hospital bed. Got to a point where I had my walker, pink tennis balls, billet cool wheels on that thing. I mean, everything was
still
done.
Same place, living in the same place.
Still living in the same spot.
And 24-hour care still?
24-hour care.
So a year. This has been a year now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's humbling. Imagine there's certain things you cannot do. When you're, even using the restroom without help.
Yeah.
Which is very, it's not ideal.
Yeah.
So showering and all that stuff wasn't a thing. I remember taking my first shower, which was probably 8 months into the thing. It was amazing, but also, shitty at the same time, right? So it was that nursing care, some were great. I mean, I fired a few of them. They were just trying to push their lifestyle onto me, or this is what you should be doing. Like a tree. So it was still pushing it every day to still get to that goal of being able to walk again.
Yeah.
So.
And what was that when you first walked? What was the time frame from the accident to when you actually first walked? And tell us about that moment.
So there's an interesting actual. In when I was in St. John and they got me moving again, right? I could walking in a walker. They said we're gonna walk you down to Skyler's room, and I
because Skyler was at St. John.
Yes, he was at St. John.
Yeah,
this is a little bit more information than maybe some want to know. So they're like you know I was just so stubborn. Like you need to eat solid food. I don't. I need just bring me
stuff with juices with all sorts of vitamins and stuff that I could sustain myself. Because there's no way I'm shitting in a deadpan. The good luck. This is it ain't happening.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
No, you need this. You need this to happen. I'm like, just bring me juices and we'll just pee it out. We're good.
Right.
They're like, this is not how that works. Yeah. Sorry. So one time they got me in the walker, and we would every so often, probably once a day, just get on that walker and start moving around. And they get me down. They said, we've got to get you to use the restroom. So they said, we're going to give you this medication. And it works like clockwork. So like we'll walk down to Skylar's room, and they put me on Skylar's bed next to her. And I looked at the nurse and she's like, it's happening.
Yeah,
like,
the alarm just went off.
Yeah, the alarm like, oh, it's happening. Like we gotta get going right now. And it's not like I was moving fast. So I had to get me in a walker and I'm walking, So I could tell you when that was a very painful experience in all of the senses. Walking and finally getting that all done was not something. It was less than ideal for that scenario. Yeah. So I don't remember. I think after they did the surgery, I believe they got me in a walker probably 2 to 3 days after that.
So when you were doing all the rehab, were you walking on your own at this time doing the rehab?
I had a walker and my wheelchair.
Yeah.
So that I use the walker to get around the house.
Yeah.
And I would bring it to certain places with me, but mostly in my wheelchair.
And so from the time of the accident through all the physical therapy, when were you done with the walker or with the...
I went from like wheelchair, walker, cane.
Yeah.
And I think I got out of my... probably wheelchair like 6-7 months or 8 months into it, and then from that to the walker, and then probably 2 to 3 months in the walker, and then I had my cane for a while. Went back to work at a certain point. I remember my dad, God love you, Bueno, who comes into the hospital. He's saying, this is terrible. I know we want you to heal. You still think you could run your projects
from here,
from the hospital bed? I'm like, I think that's probably not going to be the best, we dealt with that. So,
and during this time, like all this time, did anybody like, was there just an overwhelming or a feeling that you were going to get back to total health? Because like, you wouldn't even, when you told me that, when we were out that one, I'm like, there's no way. Like that just doesn't happen, right? I don't know if there's still, and maybe we talk a little bit about that. Yeah. Are there still some lingering things? There's got to be, right?
Yeah, So my skin, I have very little feeling, 50% less feeling in my skin below my waist, so I can pinch. And it doesn't hurt.
Okay,
pinch heavy. There was sexual dysfunction issues.
Yeah.
for a while there, that was crazy.
Yeah,
that was. That took a lot of coercion, and I mean, if you could think, if I equate that, if the Kill Bill movie, and she's like, just move your, focus on that toe.
Yeah.
The inner thoughts and the to make things work.
Yeah.
Was intense. And talking with people, like they would say like, where are your spinal? And this is a funny story. I totally forgot about this. So in the hospital, they said, where you broke your back is. It's prime for sexual dysfunction.
Yeah.
And they asked me, like, for lack of being like, can you get it up?
Yeah.
I said, you're asking me while I have a tube in my schlong.
Yeah.
And this is probably not the setting
to
think about.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So I had some good friends that called into the hospital, and it was for scientific purposes only. And I said, girls, we have a problem here.
Yeah.
And we're going to see if something works.
Yeah.
But I need your help.
Yeah.
I can't do this on my own.
Yeah.
So I said, you guys, maybe if you could, just take your tops off.
Yeah.
And
in the hospital.
In the hospital.
Yeah.
And just like run your hands up my leg and see if we can get some activity.
Yeah.
So they did. And right at the same time that they started take their tops off.
The Dr. Joel Matta walks in.
Yeah. And the one that performed the surgery.
No, the one that actually introduced me to the doctor that did all
the
math.
He was a pelvic guy.
Yeah, yeah, hip and pelvis guy. And Joel Matta, he's very dry sense of humor.
He
never smiled or anything like that. I have never seen a grin on his face as large as I had seen this moment. I mean, he was dying laughing. And at every time, I mean, I think that was a very memorable experience for him. And needless to say, things worked in that sense where there was, you know, some activity down there, but the functionality took 16 months.
Wow.
To actually really work.
Yeah.
Which was, that was beyond frustrating. You can't even imagine that. And I don't, you know, wish any that upon anybody. I mean, I've met people that were in that situation when I was in. This one gentleman in particular at the Dodger game that had this issue indefinitely.
Yeah.
And he was good about it. Like, that's not me, bro. I'm going to get through this.
Yeah.
And there was one individual, the only one individual that was able to make this, you know, make things actual work. And the person's my current wife. So it was
good.
Yeah.
Pick the right one.
Yeah.
So going through this and kind of like wrapping this up.
Yeah.
Like, that's an experience you have middle of your life before you have kids. How has that changed like your perspective on how you live life, how you work, how you are as a husband, how you are as a dad, all that?
Well, I mean, I'm always happy, right? I mean, people will throw situations at me that may be tough. And I can always reflect on, you know, what has transpired in my past and get through this. There's nothing that you can do to me that's gonna keep me down. I will get through whatever challenge you put to me. I'm gonna make sure that I get through it. So I'm
before
always...
you finish there, because you are like, dude, you're like sunshine. There's two guys I know, you and a kid I know from Laguna Beach, like. The sun's always shining on you guys, right? There's no rainy days, right? Were you like that before?
I mean, I always had a good sense of humor. I've always had a good outlook on things.
Yeah.
After this, I mean, it was substantially exacerbated there.
Yeah.
So I was a lot more in tune with things. And I appreciate things more and more.
Yeah.
So you only get one life to live. Live it, you know, within reason.
Yeah. Right?
And we're blessed to be here every single day. We're blessed to have our kids. I mean, look at their faces. And I'm here for them, you know, and my wife and my family and my friends. But, I mean, they're the reason I've survived this thing. I mean, they're my purpose. And now I just want to take care of them and to the best of my abilities and work my ass off, you know, for my wife and my kids.
Yeah. So kind of in ending, if there were a billboard that best described you or any sort of motto or battle cry that you live by, is there some quote or something that you would say?
You know, I think about that. I mean, what would be, you know, you say battle cry or, you know, just appreciate the time you have on this planet and cherish the moments that you have with each other and live in the moment, not for the moment.
Yeah. Well, brother, I appreciate you being here. I look forward to many more memories at Catalina on our boats.
Yep.
So last question, any helicopter since?
Multiple.
Really? So you're just like, I'm okay.
Well, I mean, it's funny when I get on these helicopters, it's usually people are Rochambeauing. If they're going to go with me or not, because like, what are the odds of it happening again?
Yeah.
That scenario. Yeah. So we've done a couple of fishing trips or numerous fishing trips. Like,
I appreciate you, brother. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to our podcast room. If you've enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support us, please share your favorite episodes with others or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from your host, Tim Smith, you can follow me on Instagram at Tim Smith Real Estate. That's all from me. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to Room, presented by The Smith Group. This episode was hosted by Tim Smith and produced by Michelle Akers. Chris Stacey is our studio director. Editing by Jake Austin. Special thanks to Pacific Staging and Sandy Newport.